Chapter 8. And he would remember it. The five of them standing at the edge of the pit above the empty coffin. Then with another limber, flowing motion like his twins, the second Gowrie came up out of the grave and stooped, and with an air of rapt, displeased, even faintly outraged concern, began to brush and thump the clay particles from the lower legs of his trousers. The first twin moving as the second stooped, going straight to him with a blind, unhurried, undeviable homing quality about him, like the other of a piece of machinery. The other spindle, say, of a lathe, traveling on the same ineluctable shaft to its socket, and stooped too, and began to brush and strike the dirt from the back of his brother's trousers. And this time, almost a spadeful of dirt slid down across the out-slanted lid and rattled down into the empty box, almost loud enough or with mass and weight enough to produce a small, hollow echo. "Now he's got two of them," his uncle said. "Yes," the sheriff said. "Where?"
"Dern two of them," old Gowrie said. "Where's my boy, sheriff?"
"We're going to find him now, Mr. Gowrie," the sheriff said. "And you were smart to bring them hounds. Put your pistol up and let your boys catch them dogs and hold them till we get straightened out here."
"Never you mind the pistol nor the dogs neither," old Gowrie said. "They'll trail and they'll catch anything that ever run or walked either. But my boy and that Jake Montgomery, if it was Jack Montgomery, whoever it was found laying in my son's coffin, never walked away from here to leave no trail."
The sheriff said, "Hush now, Mr. Gowrie." The old man glared back up at the sheriff. He was not trembling, not eager, baffled, amazed, not anything. Watching him, he thought of one of the cold, light-blue, tear-shaped, apparently heatless flames which balance themselves on even less than tiptoe over gas jets.
"All right," the old man said. "I'm hushed. And now you get started. You're the one that seems to know all about this, that sent me word out to my breakfast table at 6 o'clock this morning to meet you here. Now you get started."
"That's what we're going to do," the sheriff said.
"We're going to find out right now where to start."
He turned to his uncle, saying in the mild, rational, almost diffident voice,
"It's, say, around 11 o'clock at night. You got a mule, or maybe it's a horse. Anyway, something that can walk and tote a double load, and a dead man across your saddle. And you ain't got much time. That is, you ain't got all the time. Of course, it's around 11 o'clock when most folks is in bed, and a Sunday night, too, when folks have got to get up early tomorrow to start a new week in the middle of cotton planting time. And there ain't any moon, and even if folks might still be moving around, you're in a lonely part of the country where the chances all are you won't meet nobody. But you still got a dead man with a bullet hole in his back, and even at 11 o'clock, day's going to come sooner or later.
All right. What would you do?" They looked, stared at one another. Or, that is, his uncle stared. The two thin, bony, eager face. The bright, intent, rapid eyes. And opposite, the sheriff's vast, sleepy face. The eyes not staring, apparently not even looking, blinking almost drowsily, the two of them cutting without speech across all that too. "Of course," his uncle said, "into the earth again. And not far, since, as you said, daylight comes sooner or later, even when it's still just 11 o'clock. Especially when he still had time to come back and do it all over again, alone, by himself. No hand but his on the shovel. And think of that, too. The need, the terrible need, not just to have it all to do again, but to have to do it again for the reason he had. To think that he had done all he possibly could, all anyone could have asked or expected him to do, or even dreamed that he would have to do, was as safe as he could hope to be.
and then to be drawn back by a sound, a noise, or perhaps he blundered by sheer chance on the parked truck, or perhaps it was just his luck, his good fortune. Whatever god or jinn or genie looks after murderers for a little while, keeps him secure and safe until the other fates have had time to spin and knot the rope. Anyway, to have to crawl, tie the mule or horse or whatever it was to a tree, and crawl on his belly back up here to lie. Who knows? Perhaps just behind the fence yonder, and watch a meddling old woman and two children who should have been 2 hours ago in bed 10 miles away wreck the whole careful edifice of his furious labor, undo the work not merely of his life but of his death, too. His uncle stopped, and now he saw the bright, almost luminous eyes glaring down at him. "And you? You couldn't have had any idea Miss Habersham was coming with you until you got home. And without her, you could have had no hope whatever that Alexander would come with you alone at all. So if you ever really had any idea of coming out here alone to dig this grave up, don't even tell me." "Let that be now," the sheriff said. "All right. Somewhere in the ground." "And what sort of ground? What dirt digs easiest and fastest for a man in a hurry and by himself, even if he has a shovel? What sort of dirt could you hope to hide a body in quick, even if you never had nothing but a pocket knife?" "In sand," his uncle said immediately, rapidly, almost indifferently, almost inattentively. "In the bed of the branch. Didn't they tell you at 3 o'clock this morning that they saw him going there with it? What are we waiting for?" "All right," the sheriff said. "Let's go then." Then, to him, "Show us exactly where." "Except that Alexander said it might not have been a mule," he said. "All right," the sheriff said. "Horse then. Show us exactly where." He would remember it. Watching the old man clap the pistol again, butt forward into his armpit, and clamp it there with the stump of the arm, while the one hand unbuttoned the shirt, then took the pistol from the armpit and thrust it back inside the shirt, then buttoned the shirt again, then turned even faster, quicker than the two sons half his age, already in front of everybody when he hopped back over the fence and went to the mare and caught reins and pommel all in one hand, already swinging up. Then the two cars dropping in second speed against gravity back down the steep pitch until he said, "Here," where the pickup's tracks slewed off the road into the bushes, then back into the road again, and his uncle stopped. And he watched the fierce, old, stump-armed man jump the buckskin mare up out of the road into the woods on the opposite side, already falling away down toward the branch. Then the two hounds flowing up the bank behind him, and then the mule with the two identical wooden-faced sons on it. Then he and his uncle were out of the car, the sheriff's car bumper to bumper behind them, hearing the mare crashing on down toward the branch, and then the old man's high, flat voice shouting at the hounds, "Hi! Hi! Come on, boy! At him, Ring!" And then his uncle handcuffed them through the steering wheel. And then the sheriff, "No, we'll need the shovels." And he had climbed the bank, too, listening off and downward toward the crashing and the shouts. Then his uncle and the sheriff and the two Negroes carrying the shovels were beside him. Although the branch crossed almost at right angles the highway just beyond where the dirt road forked away, it was almost a quarter mile from where they now stood, or walked, rather, and although they could all hear old Gowrie still whooping at the dogs and the crashing of the mare and the mule, too, in the dense thicket below, the sheriff didn't go that way, bearing instead off along the hill almost parallel with the road for several minutes, and only beginning to slant away from it when they came out into the sawgrass and laurel and willow choked flat between the hill and the branch. and on across that, the sheriff in front until he stopped, still looking down, then turned his head and looked back at him, watching him as he and his uncle came up.
"Your secretary was right the first time," the sheriff said. "It was a mule."
"Not a black one with a rope burn," his uncle said. "Surely not that. Not even a murderer is that crassly and arrogantly extrovert."
"Yes," the sheriff said. "That's why they're dangerous. Why we must destroy them or lock them up."
And looking down, he saw them too. The narrow, delicate, almost finicking mule prints out of all proportion to the animal's actual size. Mashed, pressed deep, too deep for any one mule, no matter how heavy, carrying just one man into the damp muck. The tracks filled with water, and even as he watched, a minute aquatic beast of some sort shot across one of them, leaving a tiny, thread-like spurt of dissolving mud. And standing in the trail, now that they had found it, they could see the actual path itself through the crushed, shoulder-high growth in suspension, held like a furrow across a field or the frozen wake of a boat, crossing the marsh arrow straight until it vanished into the jungle which bordered the branch. They followed it, walking in it, treading the two sets of prints, not going and returning, but both going in the same direction. Now and then the print of the same hoof superposed on its previous one. The sheriff still in the lead, talking again, speaking aloud but without looking back, as though he thought at first to no one.
"He wouldn't come back this way. The first time he didn't have time. He went back straight up the hill that time, woods or not and dark or not. That was when he heard whatever it was he heard."
Then he knew who the sheriff was talking to.
"Maybe your secretary was whistling up there or something, being in a graveyard that time of night."
Then they stood on the bank of the branch itself, a broad ditch, a channel through which, during the winter and spring rains, a torrent rushed, but where now there flowed a thin current scarcely an inch deep and never much over a yard wide from pool to pool along the blanched sand. And even as his uncle said, "Surely the fool," the sheriff, 10 yards or so further along the bank, said, "Here it is." And they went to him, and then he saw where the mule had stood tied to a sapling, and then the prints where the man himself had thrashed on along the bank, his prints also deeper than any man, no matter how heavy, should have made. And he thought of that, too. The anguish, the desperation, the urgency in the black dark and the briars and the dizzy, irrevocable fleeing on seconds, carrying a burden man was not intended to carry. Then he was hearing a snapping and thrashing of underbrush still further along the bank, and then the mare, and then old Gowrie shouted, and then another crash which would be the mule coming up, and then simple pandemonium. The old man shouting and cursing, and the yelping of the hounds, and the thudding sound a man's shoe makes against a dog's ribs. But they couldn't hurry any more, thrashing and crashing their own way through the tearing, clinging briars and vines until they could look down into the ditch and the low mound of fresh, shaled earth into which the two hounds had been digging, and old Gowrie still kicking at them and cursing. And then they were all down in the ditch except the two Negroes.
"Hold up, Mr. Gowrie," the sheriff said. "That ain't Vincent."
But the old man didn't seem to hear him. He didn't even seem aware that anyone else was there. He seemed even to have forgot why he was kicking the dogs, that he had merely set out to drive them back from the mound, still hobbling and hopping after them on one leg and the other poised and cocked to kick even after they had retreated from the mound and were merely trying to dodge past him and get out of the ditch into safety. Still kicking at them and cursing after the sheriff caught him by his one arm and held him. "Look at the dirt," the sheriff said. "Can't you see? He hardly took time to bury it. This was the second one, when he was in the hurry, when it was almost daylight and he had to get it hidden. And they could all see now. The low hummock of fresh dirt lying close under the bank, and in the bank above it the savage, ragged marks of the shovel, as if he had hacked at the bank with the edge of the blade like swinging an axe. And again, thinking, the desperation, the urgency, the frantic, hand-to-hand combat with the massy, intolerable inertia of the earth itself, until enough of it shaled off and down to hide what he had to hide. This time they didn't need even the shovels. The body was barely covered. The dogs had already exposed it, and he realized now the true magnitude of the urgency and desperation. The frantic and desperate bankrupt in time who had not even enough of it left to hide the evidence of his desperation and the reason for his urgency. It had been after 2 o'clock when he and Alexander, even two of them working with furious speed, had got the grave filled back up again. So that by the time the murderer, not only alone, but who had already moved 6 feet of dirt and then put it back once since the sun set yesterday, had the second body out and the grave filled for the second time, it must have been daylight. Later than daylight, perhaps. The sun itself watching him while he rode for the second time down the hill and across to the branch. Morning itself watching him while he tumbled the body beneath the bank's overhang, then hacked furiously from it just enough dirt to hide the body temporarily from sight, with something of that frantic desperation of the wife, flinging her peignoir over the lover's forgotten glove. Lying, the body, face down, and only the back of the crushed skull visible until the old man stooped and with his one hand jerked it stiffly over onto its back. "Yep," old Gowrie said in the high, brisk, carrying voice. "It's that Montgomery, damned if it ain't," and rose lean and fast as a tripped watch spring, yelling, shouting at the hounds again. "Hi, boys, find Vincent," and then his uncle shouting too to make himself heard. "Wait, Mr. Gowrie, wait." Then to the sheriff. "He was a fool then, just because he didn't have time, not because he is a fool. I just don't believe it twice." Looking around, his eyes darting. Then he stopped them on the twins. He said sharply, "Where's the quicksand?" "What?" one of the twins said. "The quicksand," his uncle said. "The quicksand bed in the branch here. Where is it?"
"Quicksand?" old Gowrie said. "Son of a bitch, Laura. Put a man in quicksand? My boy in quicksand?"
"Shut up, Mr. Gowrie," the sheriff said. Then to the twin, "Well, where?" But he answered first. He had been intending to for a second or so. Now he did.
"It's by the bridge."
Then, he didn't know why, and then that didn't matter either. It wasn't Alexander that time. It was Highboy. "Under the highway bridge," the twin corrected, "where it's been all the time." "Oh," the sheriff said, "which one was Highboy?" And he was about to answer that. Then suddenly the old man seemed to have forgot about his mare, too. Whirling, already running before any of them moved, and even before he himself moved, running for several strides against the purchaseless sand while they watched him, before he turned and with that same cat-like agility he mounted the mare with, clawed himself one-handed up the steep bank and was thrashing and crashing on out of sight before anybody else except the two Negroes who had never quitted it were even up the bank. "Jump," the sheriff said to the twins. "Catch him." But they didn't. They thrashed and crashed on after him, one of the twins in front, then the rest of them, and the two Negroes pell-mell through the briars and brush,
on back along the branch and out of the jungle into the cleared right-of-way below the road at the bridge. He saw the sliding hoof marks where High Boy had come almost down to the water and then refused. The stream, the water crowded over against the opposite concrete revetment, flowing in a narrow band whose nearer edge faded without demarcation into an expanse of wet sand as smooth and innocent and markless of surface as so much milk. He stepped, sprang over a long willow pole lying above the bank edge and coated for 3 or 4 feet up its length with a thin patina of dried sand, like when you thrust a stick into a bucket or vat of paint. And even as the sheriff shouted to the twin in front, "Grab him, you!" he saw the old man jump feet first off the bank and with no splash, no disturbance of any sort, continue right on, not through the bland surface, but past it, as if he had jumped not into anything, but past the edge of a cliff or a windowsill, and then stopping, half disappeared as suddenly with no shock or jolt. Just fixed and immobile as if his legs had been cut off at the loins by one swing of a scythe, leaving his trunk sitting upright on the bland, depthless, milk-like sand. "All right, boys," old Gowrie cried, brisk and carrying. "Here he is. I'm standing on him." And one twin got the rope bridle from the mule, and the leather one, and the saddle girth from the mare, and using the shovels like axes, the Negroes hacked willow branches while the rest of them dragged up other brush and poles and whatever else they could reach or find or free. And now both twins and the two Negroes, their empty shoes sitting on the bank, were down in the sand, too, and steadily there came down from the hills the ceaseless, strong murmur of the pines, but no other sound. Yet although he strained his ears, listening in both directions along the road, not for the dignity of death, because death has no dignity, but at least for the decorum of it, some little at least of that decorum which should be every man's helpless right until the carrion he leaves can be hidden from the ridicule and the shame. The body coming out now, feet first, gallowsed up and out of the inscrutable suck to the heave of the crude tackle, then free of the sand with a faint smacking plop like the sound of lips perhaps in sleep, and in the bland surface, nothing. A faint wimple wrinkle, already fading, then gone like the end of a faint, secret, fading smile. And then on the bank now, while they stood about and over it, and he was listening, harder than ever now, with something of the murderer's own frantic urgency both ways along the road, though there was still nothing. Only hearing, recognizing his own voice, apparently, long after everyone else had. Watching the old man, coated to the waist with the same thin patina of sand like the pole, looking down at the body, his face wrenched and his upper lip wrenched upward from the lifeless porcelain glare and the pink, bloodless gums of his false teeth. "Oh, gee, Uncle Gavin. Oh, gee, Uncle Gavin, let's get him away from the road. At least let's get him back into the woods."
"Steady," his uncle said. "They've all passed now. They're all in town now."
And still watching as the old man stooped and began to brush clumsily with his one hand at the sand clogged into the eyes and nostrils and mouth, the hand looking curious and stiff at this which had been shaped so supple and quick to violence, to the buttons on the shirt and the butt and hammer of the pistol, then the hand went back and began to fumble at the hip pocket, but already his uncle had produced a handkerchief and extended it. But that was too late, too, as kneeling now the old man jerked out the tail of his shirt and, bending to bring it close, wiped the or at the dead face with it, then bending tried to blow the wet sand from it as though he had forgotten the sand was still damp. Then the old man stood up again and said in the high, flat, carrying voice in which there was still no real inflection at all,
"Well, Sheriff?"
"It wasn't Lucas Beecham, Mr. Gowrie," the sheriff said.
Jake Montgomery was at Vincent's funeral yesterday. And while Vincent was being buried, Lucas Beecham was locked up in my jail in town.
I ain't talking about Jake Montgomery, Sheriff, old Gowrie said.
Neither am I, Mr. Gowrie, the sheriff said. Because it wasn't Lucas Beecham's old 41 Colt that killed Vincent, either.
And watching, he thought, no, no, don't say it, don't ask.
And for a while he believed the old man would not, as he stood facing the sheriff, but not looking at him now, because his wrinkled eyelids had come down, hiding his eyes, but only in the way they do when somebody looks down at something at his feet, so you couldn't really say whether the old man had closed them or was just looking down at what lay on the ground between him and the sheriff. But he was wrong. The eyelids went up again and again. The old man's hard, pale eyes were looking at the sheriff. Again his voice, to 900 men out of 901, would have sounded just cheerful.
What was it killed Vincent, Sheriff?
A German Luger automatic, Mr. Gowrie, the sheriff said. Like the one Buddy McCallum brought home from France in 1919, and traded that summer for a pair of foxhounds. And he thought how this was where the eyelids might even should have closed again. But again, he was wrong. Only until the old man himself turned, quick and wiry, already in motion, already speaking, peremptory and loud, not brookless of opposition or argument, simply incapable of conceiving either.
All right, sons, let's load our boy on the mule and take him home.